last time I was in this room, it was in a religion 1350, which you guys will learn in the Christian heritage class. There's about, it was full, so there's about 300 freshmen in the room, and I walked up to the podium for the first time, and I said, "Don't worry, I speak English." I could tell by the amount of laughter that people were wondering whether I spoke English. For the 800th time, you've heard this in the last 2 weeks, I'm guessing. Welcome to Baylor. We are tremendously glad you're here. I read a number of you guys this afternoon. Who's a university scholar here? Luke Ward Friedrich, who's a university scholar here? How about who's in the lead or Alan Austin? And then, should I put their hands together, the people that are Renaissance scholars? Okay. You are nerds, but they're like the super nerds. Because they started coming to the audience program as high school students. And we did some of this stuff together way back when you guys were young. So I'm very glad to meet you. If I meet you and need your contact advising you as a university scholar, or have you as a Renaissance scholar, or you're the lead Alan Dawson, and I don't remember your name, don't take it personally. I have an issue. All white people look the same to me. I'd like to say that. I can say that to some of my best friends are white. I may say hey, but I may say what a dog or something like this. Dr. Wiley, by the way, was too humble to acknowledge that he has got a great jump shot in the basketball court. So, that's the really important thing to take away. I just want to talk about this book for a few minutes, which I'm glad you guys took some of your summer to read. I think it's a tremendous book. When I was finishing graduate school at Duke University, I was doing my PhD thing, which really focused on a particular specialized topic. I got hired at Baylor, and the Department of Religion, where I teach, said the one class we'll be teaching every semester is bioethics. And I said, "Great, I know all about bioethics," which is a lie. I didn't know anything about bioethics. So I went around. Duke asking, some of the top ethicists in the world, if you have to pick one book to have students read in an introductory undergraduate bioethics class, what would you suggest? And you got the kind of gamut of standard books, Foundations of Bioethics, Principles of Bioethics, right? The top names and the top scholars. The one book that everyone that I went to suggested was The Spirit Catches You When You Fall Down. And when I heard that title, I'm guessing I thought what many of you guys thought. That it was a book about charismatic Christianity. Your chances to fall down, it hasn't happened to me, but hopefully some of you guys have. And so I started reading the book, and it was interesting to me because I'm also Southeast Asian, didn't need, and I do know the long spent a bit of their generation in Southeast Asia. So, from that, I started reading this book, and since I've been here, I've taught bioethics, I think, 16 times. Usually there's about 40 students in the class. We've read every semester. Every semester, this book changed lives. And I hope you've had some of that experience, not simply because of this book, but because of a forecast of what your Baylor experience will be like, what the next 4 years of your life will be like. So it's kind of from that perspective, I just want to say, kind of three observations about the book, and I do hope we have a couple minutes for you guys to raise some of your own observations or what particular questions you had in reading the book. So let me begin with the end. This is on page 287. I think it's the same on all the different editions. Okay, we're all doing it. Okay, 287. Bottom of the page. You'll remember this is the part where the family is trying once again to get the spirit to return to Leah. With the hope that, she'll be made better. So this is the end of the book. Inside the apartment, the spirit money is burned and sent to the realm of the unseen. The gong sounded, the twigs leaped, Neve's horse galloped faster and faster. The soul caller looked out toward Neve's cloaked tree and chanted, "Where are you? Where have you gone? Are you visiting your brother? Are you visiting your sister? Are you visiting your cousin? Are you looking at a flower? Are you in Laos? Are you in Thailand? Are you in the sky? Have you gone to the sun? Have you gone to the moon? Come home to your house. Come home to your mother. Come home to your father. Come home to your sisters. Come home to your brother. I am calling you. I am calling you. Come home through this door. Come home to your family. Come home. Come home. Come home. Come home. Come home." I want to ask you guys, when you read this part of the book, and just by a show of hands, how many of you wanted Leah's spirit to return? Okay. So most of us, it's kind of like asking, did you want her to get better? Okay. Now let me again with a show of hands, how many of you thought that her spirit would come back? Okay, are you guys willing to say what you mean by that?
I thought either she would be reunited as she died into the spiritual world.
Okay.
Or maybe earlier in the book, after she was in the coma for a while, I kind of got the hint that she wasn't going to get better.
Okay.
But earlier in the book, I thought she would be like a city need, or and she would be really powerful.
Okay.
Or something for good.
What do you mean when you were hoping to spare the return?
Well, it seemed like it was almost going to be the stereotypical ending, like Disney movie thing where they all die and then they're all dead at the last second. And I was kind of hoping that that wouldn't happen because that would be cheesy, but I didn't want to see the character to die.
Right.
So,
it's, you're exactly right, it's a cheesy Disney ending, but we're a cheesy Disney people, right? We've been raised in a culture where we want happy endings. And a happy ending would be the spirit return. Now, you guys know that Leo Lee just died last year, right? Yeah. So, this book was written in the 90s. She lived with her family. This picture was actually taken after the big one. I mean, look how remarkable she was. That tells you how well they take care of their children, even their most needy children. They took care of her for a number of years, and it was just last fall that she passed away. One of the things I have my students do is write letters to her family, talking about how much her story impacted their lives, especially since so many of my students are headed off to medical school and this kind of thing, and how they think about this as doctors. Okay. What I want to talk about is the end, and how we experience the end. And what I want to suggest is three things to you. One, how Fatima wants you not to read this book. Right? What she doesn't want you to take away from it, because I'm guessing a lot of them are attempting to take this thing away from it. Second, I want to say a couple things about the moral conditions that this book illuminates, that what this book tells us about the contemporary moral conditions that we live in. The third thing is I want to offer a couple observations and comments about what I think this says about practicing medicine if you're a Christian, and how amazingly difficult I think that is. Especially because I know a number of you guys obviously are Christians, and I'm guessing a bunch of you are also pre-med. So those are the kind of three things I want to talk about. So the first thing, this book, the subtitle of this book is something like The Collision of Cultures, right? And so one of the things you're going to be tempted to do in walking away from this book is to think that Adam Chatterton's point is something like this. If you become a doctor, right, this is what you're going to be tempted to think, and this is what I'm thinking she doesn't want you to think. Right? If you become a doctor, be a doctor who, in taking a medical inventory of your patient, takes into consideration not only their physiology, right, not only their medical history, but also their culture. Right? Why? Because in this book, The Collision of Cultures is precisely that. The mall has a culture, and Western medicine has another culture. And insofar as you inhabit the space called Western medicine, say as a physician, then you need to take into consideration that person's culture. Why? Because if you take into consideration that person's culture, right, things like they think fear, cause, illness, or the departure of spirit caused illness, right, the history of how they take care, remember the amazing, the spectacular beginning about how they birth children, right? One suggestion, again, the temptation, one of the suggestions you walk away with the idea that if you're going to be a doctor, learn people's cultures, right? And so when you ask your patient, you ask her, okay, tell me what your issue is, right? She says, I have such and such symptoms, and then you say, tell me about the symptoms, and then eventually you should ask them kind of a question like, I see that you're Asian. Do you, did you eat something strange? Right? Does your culture normally eat something strange? And maybe that would cause your stomach issues. Right? And so what we do is we take a complete inventory. An inventory of their body and of their spirit. Right? In other words, you take into consideration their culture when you treat them. And so one different way you are tempted to do with this book is to think that that is saying, if you're going to be a doctor, take into consideration the culture of your patients. I think that is exactly the opposite of what she is suggesting. The thesis of Fatiman's book is not taking into consideration your patient's culture. The first thing she wants you to do is to take into consideration your own culture. The assumption that what I need to do as a doctor is to take into consideration that other person's culture exposes and betrays the one great cultural prejudice of Western medicine, which is what? That everyone else in the world is stuck in their culture, and that I, as a doctor, have somehow escaped my culture. Right? That's the prejudice. It's the peculiar habit of Western people to think everyone else is stuck in their culture, but we Westerns, by way of science or enlightenment or some kind of political reason, have escaped and left behind our culture. What's the problem with thinking that way? The problem is you cannot help but look down upon those with culture. You see the mom coming down the street, the person that obviously can't leave behind her cultural presumptions. You, because of your intellectual genius, have left yours behind, you immediately see her as a problem. So Fatiman is not suggesting what you do as a doctor is take a more complete inventory, and that would entail learning about their culture. The first thing you have to do, right, and this is articulated, let me read you this quote. This is articulated on 261. This is Arthur Kleinman, who's a social anthropologist in the medical school at Harvard University. He says on 261 this, bottom of the page. You need to understand that as powerful an influence as the culture of the mom patient and her family is on this case, the culture of biomedicine is equally powerful. If you can't see that your own culture has its own set of interests, emotions, and biases, how can you expect to deal successfully with someone else's culture? If you are a person who has been trained, and I guarantee you, being trained in the sciences and being trained as a doctor will encourage this thinking. If you are a person who thinks that culture is something that should be left behind, then you will look upon people who cannot, quote, leave behind their culture as easily as you as problems to be solved. In the same way that they are bearers of illness or disease or injury, you will think they are bearers of another problem, and maybe a greater problem, because that problem, culture, will get in the way of their healing. But what I'm suggesting to you is that entire way of thinking, that entire framework, itself is a cultural presumption. That culture can be left behind, that culture should be left behind. The one thing that may be most unique about Western culture is that we are one of the very few cultures in human history who actually think this. That culture should be left, can be left behind, and that it should. And if it can't, it becomes a type of problem. Right? Never forget that the entire history of colonization was driven by these sets of presumptions. So the rest of the world was unenlightened, stuck in their culture. Kant said, right, the great philosopher Kant said, Africans stuck in the dirt. And what we enlightened Western people do is go and free them from that. The temptation is to make medicine part of that state enterprise. So what you're going to do, what your white coat does, is say something like, you can trust me. I've been purified of culture. A deadly set of presumptions. What fathoms that so beautifully in this book, from the perspective of the mom, is not showing how strange the mom culture is, but how strange what? Western culture is. Right? To us, of course, it's not strange. We're raised in it. Right? We just think it's quite normal. How many of you guys are athletes? How many of the men in this room were athletes? The story will not appeal as much. I mean, this is a diet story. Okay, how many of you guys are athletes in high school? Okay. Do you guys remember your physical? Okay, that means you do. Okay. Failing a physical means going there, the doctor comes in the white coat and tells you to drop your board. That is a strange behavior. Right? There's nowhere else in our society where that would be acceptable for a guy to tell me to drop my board. Much less what he's about to do. That is a strange behavior. We don't think it's strange because the white coat tells us it's not strange. Any one of us knows how strange medical culture is if you've ever spent a significant amount of time in the hospital, especially if you're ill. Right? One of my good friends, Peter, 35 years old, diagnosed recently with stage 4 cancer, which, if you don't know what that means, the best way to put it is there's no stage 5. I spent a bit of time in the hospital with Peter. You know, I feel like I'm not an entirely stupid person. I feel like I can understand something. So every time the doctor came in, he would come in and he'd be like, and this is literally what it sounded like to me. Your condition is blah, 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 blah. And then you do blah, 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 then blah, 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 blah. It's as if they expect you to learn their language and then blame you if you don't know what to ask. Right? It's the arrogance and authority of Western culture that presumes if you don't understand, there's something wrong with you. And so that's why for many of us, medicine, going into the hospital is such a strange experience. But we've been taught to think it's an experience and an authority that we must submit to. So the first thing is that it's simply to claim that the idea here isn't to learn other people's cultures. The idea is to understand your own culture. And for us Westerners, the main thing we want to understand about our culture is there's a prejudice about other cultures in it. Only from that will you learn to love and respect other cultures. Right? If you think culture is able to be left behind, how will you ever learn to love another culture? Because your prejudice will always be you shouldn't have kept that thing. Right, so that's the first thing. The second thing is this. I want to get to the idea of moral collision and what this says about contemporary medicine, and especially those of you guys that want to be physicians. How many of you guys want to be physicians? Okay. All the Asian people have their hand up. Because Asian people have been taught since they're kids, there's only four professions in the world: doctor, lawyer, engineer, cook, and McDonald's. So, my daughter doesn't think I'm a real doctor, which I'm not. I'm not an MD, I'm a PhD. She says, you're not a real doctor, Dad. And I say, what do you mean? She's like, well, you actually don't do anything. To which I want to respond, how do you know? How did you find that out? That's true. The thing I want to talk about is moral collision. We no longer live in a time, if we ever did, in which we live with others who always share our moral conclusions or our moral presumptions. This, in a sense, follows the first claim. Right, that we all have cultures and we carry them around and they're not so easily discardable. What that means is that we live in a world of significant moral difference. It's true it would be easier maybe if everyone thought like you, but incidentally, not everyone does. The problem then is how do you make very, very, very difficult decisions of moral order? Let me give you an example of what I mean. The grad school I went to had a big old chapel in the middle of it. Duke University, like a lot of schools in America that were initially Christian, Duke was initially Methodist. Over time, of course, they left the Christianity behind, on the way to something else. But one of the kind of holdovers from their previous Christian age is that Duke has a huge chapel in the middle of it. And it's open to all students, right? I mean, on Sunday they have something like Christian worship, but it's supposedly open to all types of worship. When I was a grad student, there was a serious debate in the Chronicle, which is their marriage, the student newspaper, about whether gay people should be able to get married in the chapel. But it's a natural argument, because insofar as Duke is no longer specifically Christian, and the chapel is theoretically open to everyone, shouldn't any kind of people, right, any kind of person get married in the chapel? And the debate went, as you can imagine, it would go, which is similar to the debate currently going on in America, which is, you know, some version of God made Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. This is a Christian chapel, therefore you shouldn't have, lesbians and gay folks get married in there. And then you have the other side of the argument, some version of, God is a God of love, right, and he's open to all kinds of people. Right, and you just kind of have this going on. It went on for about 2 to 3 weeks. What I found really telling and informative about the debate was that the people were using the same language, right? Not only were they all speaking English, but they were using similar terms. Terms like justice, love, God. They're often even kind of quoting scripture in contrary ways. What I found interesting was that they're all speaking English, but they might as well have been speaking about 15 different languages, because they're completely speaking past each other. We no longer, if we ever did, live in a universe where everyone has the same moral presuppositions about what life is supposed to be about. What's the problem? Well, the rub comes when you need to make decisions of significant moral import. Let me give you several examples. Right, grandmother is about to die. We're not sure whether we should, continue to incubate her and put in a forced feeding tube into her stomach, or whether we should, let her die with dignity. We're not sure what counts as an extreme intervention or, say, a natural intervention. We're going to go on and on with this kind of debate about grandmother. Why? Because we have no common agreement about what life is supposed to be about. And if we have no common agreement about what life is supposed to be about, how are we going to possibly know what constitutes a good death? Same thing with children. The debate around abortion largely is reduced to the question of whether that thing inside that woman is a baby or a fetus. What's the problem? It's both. Some people have been raised to call it a baby. Others call it a fetus. Because we come from different world communities, we no longer like the common currency, the common language, the same common world commitment to know how to make decisions. What this book portrays is the violence that occurs when that happens. When we no longer have the same world currency with which to adjudicate the most pressing needs and questions of our day. We are living in that time now. It is what Tristan Engelhardt, the great bioethicist, called the moral catastrophe of our age. It is what the great philosopher Alistair MacIntyre called living after virtue. We no longer know even what we're talking about when we claim the same words. So the third point is this. What does this mean for Christians? How many of you guys are Christians of some sort? Okay, overwhelming majority. What you will find, if you're keen to the cultural reality of Western medicine, is this. Let me give you a scenario. I asked you earlier whether you thought the end of the book was a kind of cliffhanger, whether you thought, in a sense, persevere would return, right? Most of you said, I didn't believe it. How possibly do you Christians then believe that something is happening when your pastor, your preacher, your priest stands in front of the sanctuary, takes the bread, breaks it, right, and tells the Spirit coming to be with us? I mean, we do believe something is happening when the priest or the father or the pastor or the preacher says, this is my body broken for you. This is the cup of the New Testament. As often as you take it, do it in remembrance of me. We believe something is happening there, right? What I want to suggest is as different as the modern culture is from contemporary medicine, so is also Christianity from contemporary medicine. As difficult as it will be for the what it was for the mob to negotiate Western medicine, for those who fully understand and appreciate what Christian discipleship means, there's an equal difference between you and Western medicine. Let me give you three easy examples. One of the great presuppositions, right, of Western medicine, in fact, I'd be willing to say the entire enterprise of Western medicine is that we are to keep people from dying. Pretty basic. That is not a belief Christianity believes in. Christianity has always believed that there are worse things that can happen to you than death. That death is not the worst thing. That saving ourselves from dying is not the end all, the telos, the end of Christian life. In fact, we happen to be people who believe that death can produce good. And so automatically we are odds with the price, the most basic enterprise of Western medicine. Another the basic idea of Western medicine is, another basic commitment of Western medicine is that the suffering of children is a bad thing. And yet Christians believe in baptism, we claim this right in baptism, that if you raise your children Christian, they will suffer. And so automatically we are at odds with Western medicine. Yet another example, one of the most lucrative forefronts in Western medicine is artificial reproductive technology, basically allowing us to have children the way we want to. And yet a basic claim of Christianity through its entire history, one of its most interesting and unique sociological facts is that Christians in the claim in the world make uniquely that you do not need it, that you do not need to have children to live boldly. Right? Our two great exemplars, Jesus and Paul, and most of the saints never had children. But the growth of the church isn't, right, grown by the having of children, but by witnessing conversion. In other words, children for Christians is not an idol, as it is for the world. Right? These are just three basic examples. We can go on and on for the ways in which Christian, being Christian and being a Western doctor is at juggernauts, and that there will be collisions. Why do we have you read this book? Because we know you're smart. A lot of people get to medical school is that we don't want you to be doctors. If you can get in, we want you to be doctors. We just want you to be the right kind of doctors. The kind of doctors that know how to negotiate the amazing complexities that this book so beautifully and tragically illuminates for us. And this is the world in which we will be going. Our hope is that over the next 4 years, through friendships and conversations and great books and wonderful professors and boring lectures and all the rest, that you will develop the type of character that when you meet your healing, you'll know how to do better.
Thanks. Thanks so much, Dr. Tran. There's really not much that can be added to that presentation, but I'm sure a few of you might have a comment or question. Just a couple of minutes to follow up on anything that strikes you from what Dr. Tran has.